This is an ABC podcast.
This is Baby Talk Podcast with Penny Johnston.
When IVF became a viable way for couples to have a baby, there was a lot of doubts about how the process might work. Would the babies be normal? Would their development be compromised in any way? I mean, what would their health be like in later life? Would they even be able to have their own babies? As IVF and assisted reproduction has become more popular and more widely used, I don't know if you know, but it's believed that every school class in Australia will have at least one child born because of assisted reproduction. That makes a staggering 8 million adults and children worldwide. So are there specific health issues that are going to affect people born via IVF? A study just completed in Western Australia has compared the long-term health outcomes of children born from IVF to their similarly aged, naturally conceived children who are being studied right now in the longitudinal RAIN study in Western Australia. So how do the IVF children stack up?
It is staggering to see that there is absolutely no difference. And also, it was such a delight doing these assessments on these IVF children. We looked at them from 13 through to 20 years of age, and they're just a credit to their parents. It was just so marvelous to sort of see these children. And obviously, the mum had gone through so much to have them, you know, way back at the end of the 90s. And it was just marvelous to do this study. And obviously, it's a very reassuring outcome.
Roger Hart is Professor of Reproductive Medicine and Deputy Head of Division of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Western Australia. He's also Director of Fertility Services at King Edward Memorial Hospital. And he's been in charge of this research into the IVF children's health. I asked him what the trigger was to start this massive research project.
I did a substantial literature review a few years ago, which looked at the longer-term health outcomes of children born from IVF. We know that children born from IVF have a higher rate of congenital malformations. This is at birth, but their longer-term health is very small, but because there's a million cycles per year in the world, you can see these very, very subtle increases. But there is limited data on long-term health outcomes from children born from IVF. As you can imagine, it's quite difficult to follow them up 15, 20 years later. And also, what is the reference population? How do you find a control group? Because obviously they'd be quite biased in just getting somebody off the street. So that was the background, because we'd shown that potentially they have a slightly higher risk of cardiovascular risk factors, potentially thyroid problems. So these are very small studies. And so that with that concern, what I wanted to do is to set up a prospective study to look at children born from IVF in Western Australia, because we have a fantastic reference group, completely unbiased population. And these is called the RAIN study. These are children that were born in 1990, and there was 2,000 of them that have been followed up from birth. And what I wanted to do was to replicate the assessments of the RAIN study on an IVF cohort. So we had a very good representative sample of Western Australian children. So the reference group have been demonstrated to be very representative of the Western Australian children. And they're now coming up to 30 years of age. But I wanted to repeat the studies that they did in adolescence. So what I got approached all children born from IVF at the turn of the century, 2000, in Western Australia, tried to contact them through the electoral roll. Obviously, that was quite challenging and not everybody wanted to be involved. So we got 300 adolescents that were happy to be followed up. And I got NHMRC money from the government to do a longer term follow-up study of these children. So this is the largest study that's ever been undertaken. So I've done a whole load of medical assessments of them in adolescent years. But the one thing I was focusing on with this study, which is the first one we've published, because this concern about their longer-term health risks, we think this could be something called due to epigenetics. Because obviously very early in life, when a sperm meeting the egg and the embryo is developing, in IVF, that's all happening in the laboratory, where potentially that early embryo is very vulnerable to what we call programming of gene expression. Because we all have genes, but their expression is controlled by something called epigenetics, and which controls the variability even between identical twins, for instance. So that's what I wanted to do, to look at the epigenetic profile of children born from IVF at 15 and to 17 years of age, comparing to the RAIN study. And we had 1,100 RAIN study children that we had, and we had 231 of my IVF cohort that we studied. And we looked at almost a million sites of their genome, which still only represents about 3% of their genome. And we found no difference. It was obviously very reassuring and fascinating to find that out. But what it showed is that the epigenetic profile, the way that we control our genes, was no different in children born from IVF than children born naturally. And also what we did, which is quite fascinating, which was to look at epigenetic age. Amazingly, you can look at your DNA and you can actually really much work out how old you are. And perhaps you might sort of say that, you know, when you go to school reunions and things many, many years later, you'll think there was some people that perhaps have aged a bit quicker than others, and some are still looking incredibly young. And that's really your epigenetic age, is how your DNA has changed over time. And that puts you at increased risk of things like heart disease, diabetes, and potentially cancer. So it was really, really reassuring to look at these children when they're 15 or 17 years of age and find that there was no difference in their gene expression, which really, hopefully with a platform to our further studies, which we'll be publishing this year and next year and the year after, looking at the medical assessments that we've done, like heart disease, diabetic risk, thyroid disorder, all those sorts of things. So this is the largest study to date, and it is fairly unique. In what it demonstrates is the fact that there is no difference. The aging rate of the DNA and also the methylation patterns, which is the epigenetic expression of these genes, and IVF versus naturally conceived children. We did find there was a subtle difference between children born from ICSI. ICSI is usually performed for male factor infertility, where the sperm is injected into the egg. There was a slight difference between children born from ICSI and IVF. Perhaps, as you might suspect, the health of the man that had a poor sperm count, maybe that is what made there was a slight difference. We didn't find any difference between whether it was a fresh embryo or frozen embryo. You may be aware that when a woman goes through an IVF cycle, generally she will have an embryo that's fresh to transfer after her egg collection. And she may be fortunate to have some surplus embryos that she can put to be frozen for a subsequent replacement cycle or even a further child down the line if she's successful. We thaw these embryos out and we transfer them to the uterus. So despite the freezing, we found no difference. And what also we found really quite staggering is at the turn of the century that the quality control systems that were controlling the generation of the culture media that we grow the embryos in is nowhere near as good as it is now. As you imagine now, the quality control, and we're all hearing about COVID and all the sort of testing that's done, is so much greater nowadays than it was then. And so it is staggering to see that there is absolutely no difference. And also, it was such a delight doing these assessments on these IVF children. We looked at them from 13 through to 20 years of age. And they're just a credit to their parents. It was just so marvelous to sort of see these children. And obviously, the mum had gone through so much to have them, you know, way back at the end of the 90s. And it was just marvelous to do this study. And obviously, it's a very reassuring outcome.
I guess there's always in the back of your mind, considering you're sort of removing an egg from its natural environment, sticking it in chemicals, you're jabbing a hole in it to put a sperm in, freezing it. There's all these, you know, it's a pretty rough life.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes, I know. And so it's just, it's extraordinary. The pioneers of IVF, and Australia did lead the world with the pioneering of IVF. So it's an absolute credit to the pioneers and also the women that went through a huge amount of treatment to establish IVF where it is now, where 1 in 25 Australians are born from IVF. And indeed, a woman in the late 30s, it's more like 1 in 7. And, you know, it is fantastic to see the great outcome and the satisfaction for the couples with the success of the treatment. So, yes, absolutely. It obviously was a concern that what has been done is very, very artificial. But this studies to date are very reassuring. So going back to what I said, that children born from IVF do have a slightly higher rate of congenital malformations. And so obviously our speculation was, is it due to the culture environment? But evidence would suggest it's perhaps not due to the IVF per se. It's perhaps more due to the couples that need the treatment. So there are certainly some couples that will need IVF treatment that may have a genetic predisposition to a higher risk of congenital malformations in their child. So perhaps it's not the IVF that's causing any problems. It's more perhaps the couples needing treatment. You could imagine that perhaps the health of some women requiring IVF or their partners and their sperm counts and may predispose to any potential underlying problems rather than the IVF treatment per se. So I mean, for one of the things that was in our literature review with Professor Rob North from Adelaide that we published in 2013 was we showed that potentially there may be a slightly higher rate of blood pressure being slightly higher in adolescence, not sufficient to cause what we call hypertension, but early signs that there may be an increased risk of hypertensive disease in later life. But you could imagine perhaps it's not the treatment of IVF, but perhaps some of the women that may have hadn't required the treatment. So perhaps, you know, for instance, some women with polycystic ovary syndrome may have a higher requirement to need IVF treatment. And as we know, women with polycystic ovary syndrome potentially have a higher risk of hypertensive disease in later life. So that could be the background mechanism to it rather than the IVF. So you can imagine a woman that needs IVF due to perhaps the partner having a vasectomy previously, why would that cause an increased risk of blood pressure problems to the child or increased risk of congenital malformations to the child? So you can see what we haven't really done is we haven't really teased out previously what potentially the mechanisms of these things could be. So this is going one small step towards sort of showing perhaps it's not the IVF treatment that's leading to any potential abnormalities in gene expression, which may be a precursor of heart disease later in life.
Are you able to separate your IVF children into the ones that had donor DNA?
Yep.
How's that working out?
Yeah. So basically, this the treatment. One of the things that's important to say is the fact that this was obviously IVF treatment offered at the end of the 90s, 2000 was the cutoff. So the treatment that was performed then is very different to what's done now. So whereas indeed, ICSI treatment, where the sperm is injected into the egg, was actually a very small number of our patients. Probably about a third of them were ICSI, 25 to 30%. Whereas nowadays across Australia, that's more like potentially getting towards two thirds of cycles because it was used more sparingly in those early days. And so there's many things in practice was slightly different so that we excluded donor eggs and donor sperm treatment because that was a relatively small amount of the treatment. We didn't include any embryo testing. As you may be aware, nowadays it's a very common procedure to try and limit transmission of genetic disorders that we may do embryo biopsies to look for genetic abnormalities in the embryos. Certainly then in Western Australia that was and it wasn't legal to do, so there was no embryo testing that was performed then. And also it's important to clarify, I suppose, at that time double embryo transfer was a relatively common procedure, so there was a higher number of multiple pregnancies. Obviously, all any confounding factors we did control for, but there was a higher number of double embryo transfers, whereas nowadays Australia leads the world in single embryo transfer, and we have one of the lowest multiple birth rates in the world, and that's been pioneered by leaders within the Fertility Society of Australia that we should move towards single embryo transfer, and that is standard practice. So that then, in those days, it was double embryo transfer. The freezing protocols were different in those days, whereas nowadays we do rapid freezing. Whereas in those days, it was more of a slow freezing approach of embryos. Plus, also, we didn't tend to grow embryos for many days in the laboratory in those days. We only grew embryos for 2 or 3 days in the laboratory, whereas nowadays, standard is for 5 days. So that these are criticisms, obviously, of the study. But any long-term study is obviously reflecting practice 15, 20 years ago. So you're never going to get long-term follow-up from contemporary practice. But these, it's important to say that practice was a little bit different in those days, but this data is still very reassuring.
A lot of women, by the time they get to IVF, would be older. As rude as it is to refer to us as geriatric, but you know...
No, I would never do that.
Thank you. But you do have an older womb environment as well for these babies.
No, I think that's one misapprehension. The uterus is an amazing structure. It's the uterus, the effect of aging is very minimal on the uterus. So it's more, what's important is the egg. And also to an important extent, the sperm. The age of the egg and the sperm, the man who produces the sperm, is crucial. But the uterus is not a factor. Yes, there are some diseases of the uterus, like fibroids and something called adenomyosis, which do progress with time. But the uterus otherwise is a very forgiving structure, and it is not, that is not a factor. But the age of the woman embarking on IVF treatment is the most consistently predictive factor on the success. Unfortunately, late 30s onwards, the success of IVF treatment drops, natural conception as well, because of it's the age of the egg that is crucial. And yes, in our two groups, the naturally conceived age was about 30 in the RAIN study, and compared to the IVF cohort, it's about 34 years of age. So there was an age difference, which again we controlled for, because as you can imagine, women embarking on IVF treatment were generally a little bit older. They were more likely not to have had a previous child. And as you might expect, the rate of smoking was substantially less, because women embarking on IVF treatment go to huge lengths to try to make their chances the best as possible and really, really endeavour to make their health as healthy as possible. So yes, and what was staggering again, which probably might surprise you, but when this study, the rate of smoking in IVF was 8%, which you probably think is quite high, but the rate of smoking in 1990 in the RAIN study was 33%.
Wow.
Yes, it's absolutely staggering how things have changed. So smoking in the RAIN study was almost a third of the mothers. So yes, the women in the IVF cohort were older, but they were certainly probably healthier than their RAIN
yeah,
study.
Yeah, and I mean, there's plenty of the, if you want to call them free-range conceived babies, there would have been plenty of partying and drinking and smoking and carrying on like a pork chop and eating whatever you liked before you knew you were actually pregnant.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the thing that we don't think about enough. And also other doctors and other specialties really, really also need to think about it, because often by the time the woman realizes she's pregnant, many of the organs in the fetus have already developed. I mean, you know that very, very early on, you see heartbeat on an ultrasound at 6 weeks gestation. So the heart is already developed. The organ system's already developing, often before the woman knows she's pregnant. So absolutely, as you're quite rightly saying, drinking, smoking, partying, that is the most crucial stage of pregnancy. We all tend to focus at the end of pregnancy, look after yourself, you're about to deliver. Obviously, that's important for the woman's health before she delivers. But the really crucial stage of development of the fetus, and also, therefore, their risks in later life with the early origins of adult health, it relates to very early conception. And some would even say preconception. It's the health of the egg and the sperm at conception which predicts long-term health. So absolutely, I think this is something that we don't think about enough. You know, women taking any medication for any other health problem they've got, it's really crucial that they ensure that they've got good contraceptive protection, because falling pregnant and taking medication which may not be safe is obviously really, really crucial for the baby. So it's absolutely around the time of the missed period is a really crucial stage in health development.
That's not saying that women are doing the wrong thing. It's just you don't always know when you're
correct.
Pregnant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, exactly. It is a dual responsibility of the treating doctor and the patient. Absolutely. So, yeah, I lecture the medical students and general practitioners with this message, is that when a couple are thinking about starting a family, they should actually go along to the GP and have a chat about it. So this is just naturally conceived children. I'm thinking of start a family. I go along and see your GP. It sounds bonkers, as if you don't know what you're supposed to do. But actually, it's really, really important, because many of us, perhaps up to a third of us, will be taking some other medication. We'll have some other medical condition which needs to be controlled and optimized before we conceive. That may be just some simple medication, maybe getting the thyroid medication just right. But it may be things like getting health optimized, him to stop smoking and drinking, and her to maybe lose some weight. All of these very important things, which can have major impact on the chance of conceiving, but also the long-term health of the child. So this is not a women thing. This is a man and woman thing. The health of the man is crucially important for the health of the child. So no, it's not about women. This is men and women. Men have to take the responsibility as well.
Not to mention checking up on exactly when you need to be having sex to have that window
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. So yes, we always say mid-cycle is when a woman ovulates, but some women have incredibly short cycles, so she may be actually ovulating not middle of the cycle, but actually much sooner than that. So yes, so the GP can give some pointers to help the woman understand her own internal body and things like this. So absolutely. So it's really important. There's also another thing that's come out in the last couple of years, which is really crucial, why I would encourage couples to go and see their GP before they embark on trying to get pregnant, is called preconception carrier screening. We all carry genetic risk, and 1 in 23 as for instance may carry cystic fibrosis. And so there are panels available of blood tests where you can look at your risk of transmitting a genetic disorder to your child. So yes, that's another reason why tapping into the knowledge and support of the general practitioner before a couple embark on trying to get pregnant is really crucial for all these things to be discussed.
I can't say how happy I am that your research has turned out the way it is, because everybody's seen the little video of ICSI taking place and a great big needle, tiny little egg, all that sort of roughing around in the laboratory. Yeah. It doesn't seem natural, but it's good to know that it's okay.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So that's why it's so important to do this. The first child in Australia was born in 1991 from ICSI. So it just shows how relatively recent a technology it is. But there are 2 out of 3 cycles now of treatment in Australia are with ICSI treatment. So, yep, so absolutely. That's why these long-term studies are so important. We have been accepted to present in the European Society of Human Reproduction Embryology in July this year. Obviously, it'll be virtual rather than going to Paris. Our data on the cardiac assessment. So we did some very detailed cardiological assessments of children born from IVF at 15. So this is this cohort, and we compared them against the RAIN study. And obviously I can't say that the results, but it was reassuring. And also we've looked at their thyroid function. And again, it looks reassuring, whereas some preliminary data from a very, very small study showed that perhaps it wasn't quite normal. So over the next couple of years, we'll be, as we have analysed all this massive amount of data, we will hopefully be able to publish and discuss further findings over time. What goes on in the laboratory is amazing. The embryologists that work in the laboratory are fantastic and they're very, very professional. But yes, the procedures can look quite scary, injecting this sperm into the egg, but it's fantastic to see the healthy outcomes from these children, because it's a very, very successful technology and many Australians have been born through that technology, and credit to their parents and society, which is fantastic.
Are you planning to hold on to these kids for a bit longer to keep testing?
Well, I haven't ethical approval for that. I intend to do a follow-up in again after 10 years after that. So in a few years' time, I'd like to do that. But obviously that would require access to further funding, because it's incredibly expensive to do all of these follow-up studies. So I will put a further grant application, ethics application to do that. Absolutely. I think it's very, very important to do. Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, you've got the benefit of that amazing population of Perth and WA. Western Australians seem to stay push.
Yes, exactly. I'm just looking out the window now and they think, well, why on earth would you move? It is incredible that they do tend to stay around, and there's the retention in the study is, you know, the late 80s%, sort of 80-90% being able to retain them, and they've just turned 30. And what I intend to do, I've put an application into to do a full reproductive assessment of the RAIN study at 30, because as you're aware, that's a really crucial time for men and women to be looking at their reproductive potential. We have data from before they were born over the last 30 years. So I've got my fingers crossed that our grant application will be successful to study
yes,
that.
Yes, because of course reproduction of these IVF children will be really interesting as well, to see whether they perhaps inherit their parents' reproductive issues.
Particularly for male factory fertility, one would speculate that a man with a poor sperm count, maybe that their son is at increased risk of a lower sperm count. So potentially that will be conserving genes of some poor sperm genes in a subsequent population. So potentially that is right. And I do think that's the important message that I say to men who have what we call severe oligospermia, low sperm count due to unknown cause, is potentially it's important that their son gets checked out when they're 16, 18 years of age, and potentially frees some sperm, because that's one easy thing that blokes can do, which is obviously very difficult for women, is to potentially free some sperm to preserve their fertility. So that's an important message as well.
Professor Roger Hart, hopefully with good news for all the parents of IVF and assisted conception children, whose numbers continue to grow every year. Now, the results of that study are being published right now through the Health and Medical Research Council. I'll put a link on the Baby Talk website so you can check it out for yourself. And still on the subject of assisted reproduction, last week we spoke to Dr. Stephen MacArthur, Scientific Director of IVF company Genea, all about male infertility.
The most fascinating thing about sperm, I think, is the size of a sperm. So to put it in perspective, if you took a strand of your hair and cut it up into 100 pieces, the length of a sperm would only be equal to about 7 of those pieces. It's unbelievably small.
Wow.
And to think that it carries then half of all of the genetic material that will make us as an individual.
You can find that interview and indeed this one, if you'd like to listen again, on iTunes and on the ABC Listen app, and pretty much anywhere you find your podcasts these days. Baby Talk is a weekly podcast about all things to do with babies, from conception till we send them off to kindergarten. I'm Penny Johnston. I'll see you next time on Baby Talk.
ABC Baby Talk is a weekly podcast on ABC Radio, wherever you get your podcasts, and on the ABC Listen app. Like us on Facebook to find out as soon as a new episode is ready. Just search for ABC Baby Talk.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.